But if I understood what you said that my position had changed, that today I was defensive because we didn't have the evidence to prove our assertions that your government had installed long-range missiles in Cuba. Well, let me say something to you, Mr. Ambassador. We do have the evidence. We have it, and it's clear and incontrovertible. And let me say something else. Those weapons must be taken out of Cuba. And next, let me say to you that if I understood you with a trespass on credulity that excels your best, you said that our position had changed since I spoke here the other day because of the pressures of world opinion and the majority of the United Nations. Well, let me say to you, sir, you are wrong again. We have had no pressure from anyone whatsoever. We came in here today to indicate our willingness to discuss Mr. U Thant's proposals. And that is the only change that has taken place. But let me also say to you, sir, that there has been a change. You, the Soviet Union, has sent these weapons to Cuba. You, the Soviet Union, has upset the balance of power in the world. You, the Soviet Union, has created this new danger, not the United States. And you asked with a fine show of indignation why the president didn't tell Mr. Gromyko on last Thursday about our evidence. At the very time that Mr. Gromyko was blandly denying to the president that the USSR was placing such weapons on sites in the New World. Well, I'll tell you why. Because we were assembling the evidence, and perhaps it would be instructive to the world to see how a Soviet official, how far he would go in perfidy. Perhaps we wanted to know if this country faced another example of nuclear deceit, like that one a year ago, when in stealth, the Soviet Union broke the nuclear test moratorium. And while we're asking questions, let me ask you why your government, your foreign minister, deliberately, cynically deceived us about the nuclear buildup in Cuba. And finally, the other day, Mr. Zorin, I remind you that you didn't deny the existence of these weapons. Instead, we heard that they had suddenly become defensive weapons. But today, again, if I heard you correctly, you now say they don't exist, or that we haven't proved they exist. With another fine flood of rhetorical scorn. All right, sir. Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation, yes or no?
I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
World opinion right now, and you can answer yes or no. You have denied that they exist. I want to know if I've understood you correctly.
I should like to say,
sir, will you please continue your statement? You will have your answer in due course.
Continue your statement, please. You will receive the answer in the due course. Do not worry.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision. And I'm also prepared to present the evidence in this room.
Now a hotline report from Leon Pearson, NBC News, United Nations.
Who's responsible for its defense?
The Security Council has already heard this morning from one delegation, that is to say the delegation of Venezuela, in support of the United States position. And it is now hearing the opening remarks of another delegation in support of the U.S., that is to say, the United Kingdom. And you will hear the voice of Sir Patrick Dean, who a moment ago has said, spoken of the nuclear missiles of mass destruction. We go now to the floor to hear Sir Patrick Dean of the United Kingdom.
To the clear and frank speech of his representative in this council. These statements have explained the new situation with which we are now faced and the serious turn of events which has taken place in Cuba. Events which both by their very nature and by the way in which they have come about can only give rise to the deepest anxiety among peace-loving peoples of the world. The President of the United States explained to the world why it had proved necessary to take new measures to combat the threat which Soviet policy in Cuba now presents, and why he had instructed his representative at the United Nations, in the face of this clear threat to peace and security, to request this emergency session of the Security Council and to table the draft resolution which we now have before us in document S/5182. I do not intend to enter into past history, nor to add to the survey of events made by the distinguished representative of the United States. We all of us know from our own experience the tragic and terrible story which he so clearly described of agreements broken and aggressions waged by the Soviet Union. We are faced today with a most serious act of recklessness, which, as the United States representative said, cannot be tolerated. The task and duty thus cast on this council is overwhelmingly important. For the outcome of our deliberations here today will determine whether the peoples of the world can retain their respect for the United Nations and their faith that in the Security Council lies the ultimate hope for the preservation of peace. The task facing us, Mr. President, is easily described, but difficult to accomplish. Somehow, we must rebuild the world envisaged by the Charter. We must recreate an atmosphere of confidence and trust between the great powers of the world. I would ask members of this Council to compare the frankness and clarity of the statements made by the President of the United States and his representative in this Council with two other speeches which have recently been made here in the General Assembly of the United Nations itself. I refer to the speech made by the distinguished Foreign Minister of the Soviet Union, Mr. Gromyko, in the General Assembly, and to the speech of the President of Cuba when he attended the Assembly with the honors accorded to a head of state. I would like briefly to quote extracts of what they said on these occasions. The Soviet representative in this council has already referred to them in his speech, but they are of such importance that I shall repeat them again. First, Mr. Gromyko. In that section of his speech dealing with Cuba, Mr. Gromyko said the following. I'm quoting. It is also stated that the United States will be prepared to attack Cuba if it believes that Cuba is building up her forces to such a degree that she can pose a threat to the United States or to the passage of the United States to the Panama Canal, or else a threat to any state of the Western Hemisphere. Any sober-minded man knows that Cuba is not pursuing either the first or the second or the third of these goals. This is fully realized by the United States statesmen, too. They know full well that the aid rendered by the Soviet Union to Cuba to strengthen her independence does not pursue any of these goals either, since they are alien to our foreign policy. End of quotation. That, Mr. President, is the Soviet Foreign Minister's public statement about the policy of the Soviet Union and of Cuba in this Western Hemisphere. And now this is what the President of Cuba himself had to say in the General Assembly on Cuba's foreign policy. And I quote again. Faithful to these principles of its international policy and to the principles enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations, Cuba constitutes a danger to the security of no nation whatsoever of our continent. Nor has Cuba harbored in the past or at the present time any aggressive intentions against any of them. Rather, have we shown the greatest and most absolute respect for the policy of non-intervention. Convinced as we are, and as demonstrated by our own national history, that it is up to each and every people to decide in its sovereignty and without the hateful interference of foreign countries, its own historic destiny. End of quotation. Later in his speech, President Dorticos gave the following assurances, and I quote his actual words. We want peace, he said. I repeat here, we are ready to take any useful step towards the guaranteeing of peace. The end of quotation. We also heard the remarks of the distinguished representative of the Soviet Union yesterday, in which he said that the American charges about the supply of offensive weapons to Cuba were false. But he did not deny, nor did the Cuban representative deny, that the Soviet government had furnished missiles to Cuba. Mr. President, by no stretch even of the Soviet imagination can a nuclear missile with a range of over 2,000 miles in Cuba be called defensive. Here I would like to bring to the Council's notice what my own Secretary of State said when he spoke recently in London. After pointing out that international communism as practiced by the Soviet Union today is both opportunist and two-faced, and that the Soviet Union stepped in last year in Cuba to take advantage of a situation which was already explosive, Lord Hume, speaking yesterday, said the following, and I'm quoting, by putting medium-range and intermediate-range ballistic missiles into Cuba, Russia is deliberately placing her own power in a position to do three things: to threaten the United States, to threaten the Caribbean, and beyond those two, to threaten South America. We must recognize that this is plainly an act of power. At a time when the non-dissemination of nuclear weapons to non-nuclear countries is on the agenda at Geneva, Russia introduces these weapons into new places. At a time when the United Nations actually this week is beginning to debate this question and trying to carry on discussions, that is the time when the Russians do what they have not, repeat not, done in Eastern Europe. That is, put their offensive weapons onto the soil of a satellite. There is another aspect of Soviet policy of which we must be aware, said Lord Hume. Memory is short, but you will all remember that only 18 months or so ago, the Russians were operating a moratorium of nuclear tests. They broke that moratorium without notice, but it was plain from the scale of the tests that under the cover of the negotiations at Geneva, they had been preparing this great series of nuclear tests. Only last week, Mr. Khrushchev instructed Mr. Gromyko to assure President Kennedy that there were no offensive weapons in Cuba, and Russia had no intention of putting them there. Within a week of that statement by the architect of Soviet policy, it had been proved that these words were said only to deceive. At the United Nations last year, I said that no genuine peace would come to the world until this double dealing was exposed. I find it necessary to repeat that. If the world wants peace, the countries, particularly through their membership of the United Nations, must insist that these practices in double dealing must cease and cease now. I believe that this is so fundamental to the future peace of the world, because if we continue, no one can say we cannot drift into war. The Americans are therefore right to let the world see plainly what is being done in secret by the communists under their noses. Neutralism is no guarantee of safety. That is what Lord Hume said yesterday. Mr. President, my country has always held that a sovereign people has the right to choose their own ideology, government, and political way of life. We strongly believe, too, that each country has the right and the duty to look to its own defense. We ourselves are members of three purely defensive alliances, NATO, CENTO, and CETO, organizations recognized under the Charter, the purpose of which is to defend and protect the way of life and the basic freedoms in which we believe. But as we have so often repeated, these alliances are non-aggressive and threaten no one. We have never denied the right of the Cuban people to choose their own political regime, or of the Cuban government to take such defensive measures as they think necessary for their own defense. We do not dispute that a sovereign state is entitled to call for military aid from another government. In that, the governments of the United Kingdom, of the United States, of Cuba, and the Soviet Union are all agreed. But no one, Mr. President, can fit the installation of these missile sites in Cuba into that picture. Legitimate defenses are one thing. Nuclear missiles with ranges from 1,000 to over 2,000 miles are quite another. And then, add to this fact that these weapons of mass destruction are being installed in secrecy and behind a mask of duplicity. The President of the United States referred to the public and private assurances which he had received to the effect that the Soviet government would never install missile bases in Cuba. We have all heard the Soviet government boast that it has the capability to destroy the world. They have said there is no need for the Soviet government to shift its weapons for a retaliatory blow to any other country. The distinguished representative of the Soviet Union has already drawn the attention of this council to the flaunting by his government to the world of the fact that its rockets are so powerful that there is no need for them to search for sites beyond the boundaries of the Soviet Union. And yet, Mr. President, when these very assertions were being made, when disarmament discussions are in progress here in the United Nations, when there have been conversations between the United States and Soviet governments about limiting the spread of nuclear weapons, and when we are likely to debate this subject further in the General Assembly, at such a time, plans were going forward for the supply of these very weapons of destruction to the Cuban government. While the Soviet government were acting their lie, the orders were being given, plans laid, and preparations being made for the supply of missiles to Cuba. Who can possibly believe in the honesty of the Soviet government's intentions in these circumstances? Such calculated double dealing is bound to throw a sinister light on its intentions. Let us compare for a moment dispassionately what the Soviet government has said and what it has done. Let us compare the secretive and furtive way in which it has acted in Cuba with the open attitude of the governments of NATO, who have not attempted to hide the establishment by mutual agreement of their bases for the defenses of the free world. We are forced to conclude that these bases in Cuba are not for defensive purposes only. We are forced to believe that the Soviet government sees for itself some significant advantage. And when it attempts to steal this advantage in such an underhand way, the free world must alert itself to a potential threat to its security and to a grave danger to mankind. The foreign secretary of my country, when speaking in the General Assembly a month ago, described the life of the international community under the shadow of the nuclear bomb. What he then said is very true today, and I will repeat it. There are, Mr. President, he said, certain lessons which I think we can learn first from the destructive power of the nuclear bomb. The first is this, and it is perhaps the overriding fact of our present situation. There is, in fact, today a stalemate in nuclear power. And because there is a stalemate in nuclear power, there is a stalemate in power politics. It is true that it is a stalemate of fear. Nevertheless, it has brought us a respite from war. It may be that we only hold the peace by the balance of terror. Nevertheless, the peace is held, and for that at least we should be grateful. End of quotation. As I have said, we can only assume that it is in this context that the Soviet Union sees advantage to itself through its latest actions in Cuba. If not, it would never have embarked by such devious means on such a dangerous course. It must hope by this advantage to increase the area of communist domination and to gain a significant military advantage in favor of the communist bloc. I am not saying that they are right in this assessment, but what I will say is this. One of the cardinal principles upon which all our disarmament discussions have been based is that there must not be a significant change in the balance of military power. For on this balance, the security of each and every one of us, including the Soviet Union itself, depends. Mr. President, I will now return to the situation in Cuba itself. The truth is that the threat comes not from without against Cuba, but from within Cuba against its neighbors. The representatives of the Latin American countries as we have heard, met to discuss the situation as provided for in the Rio Treaty of 1947. These countries represent a voluntary association of freedom-loving peoples who have joined together for their mutual defense and mutual benefit in an organization whose existence is recognized under the Charter. We have had read to us in this council the text of the operative paragraphs of the resolution which they adopted with near unanimity. This resolution fully supports that tabled by the representative of the United States in this council. The consensus of our Latin American colleagues is that these latest moves in Cuba do indeed represent a real threat to their security. That this is the case was put to us with solemn clarity a few minutes ago by the distinguished representative of Venezuela, speaking on behalf of an entire continent. I listened to him with deep understanding and full agreement. It is the Latin American countries, Mr. President, who are in the Western Hemisphere, and it is they who are Cuba's neighbors. It is they who have the experience and the knowledge with which to judge these latest events. We agree with their assessment. Furthermore, if they are threatened, then we are threatened too. For in this nuclear age, the whole free world stands or falls together. Mr. President, my government consider that the United States government has acted properly by coming to the Security Council at the first possible moment. It is now for the Council to take immediate and urgent steps to deal with the situation. The way now to restore confidence in the Western Hemisphere is for these offensive missiles to be dismantled and withdrawn. Only then can we believe the honesty of the pronouncements made by the Soviet and Cuban leaders that they have no aggressive intentions. Let them now live up to their words and remove the threat which they have unnecessarily placed amongst us. Let them, before it is too late, withdraw these missiles, which never should have been introduced. Let them consider the real interests of the Cuban people and of the world. To quote Lord Hume once again, he said yesterday, "I hope the Russians will see in time where their policy is leading. I can promise them this. Immediately she settles down to negotiate, Russia will find the most ready response from our government. The President of the United States is clearly looking forward to the day when we can get round the table and work out solutions of all our difficulties in negotiations which are genuine." End of quotation. My government, Mr. President, fully supports the provisions of the resolution before this Council, tabled by the representative of the United States, involving, as they do, a request to the Secretary General to dispatch to Cuba a United Nations Observer Corps to assure and report on compliance. In so doing, we urge the governments of the Soviet Union and of Cuba to heed the appeal of all peace-loving peoples in the world. Thank you, Mr. President.
Le représentant du Royaume-Uni, Monsieur le Président, je dois commencer par dire que, de l'avis de mon gouvernement, nous trouvons en présence d'une des situations les plus dangereuses jamais portées à l'attention du Conseil de sécurité. Le problème est urgent et les conséquences des événements que nous connaissons sont incalculables. Nous devons...
You've just heard the remarks of the British delegate, Sir Patrick Deane, and now we're getting into the translation into the French of his remarks. What has been happening in the past hour, that is to say since 10:30 New York time, when the forward proceedings of this session began, that is to say after the translation of the Soviet remarks, what has been happening is this, very simply, two speeches, one by the delegate of Venezuela and one by the delegate of the United Kingdom, both very strongly and very reassuringly in support of the United States position. The debate will continue, we assume, after the translation of the remarks of the United Kingdom, and so far as we know, the next speaker will be the delegate of Romania. And following him, we will hear from the delegate of Ireland, delegate of France, and the delegate of China. Of those four, of course, we can expect to have support for the United States position from the delegate of Ireland, France, and China, whereas the delegate of Romania, of course, will support the Cuban or the Soviet position in this matter. We shall resume the coverage of the Security Council debates after the translation and when further speeches are undertaken. This is Leon Pearson, NBC News at the United Nations.
This has been a special hotline report from NBC News at the United Nations. Stay tuned to your NBC station for other hotline reports from the United Nations on the important events there. For hotline reports on other breaking stories, and for the latest news every hour on the hour. This is NBC Radio, the network where news comes first.